This session of the Sunstone Symposium. My name is Ken Cannon. I'm the chair of this session. Let me first introduce our speaker and then the respondent. Jeff Wadups is the speaker who will be giving his paper, The Changing Economic Environment Impacts on Gender Roles and Labor Force Participation. He is currently an assistant professor of economics at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He holds a bachelor's degree and a PhD in economics from the University of Utah. His fields of specialty are labor economics, political economy, and quantitative methods. The respondent is Nola Wallace. She is a member of the National Advisory Board of the Sunstone Foundation. She has published in Sunstone a psalm called Contingency of Woman. She is a sculptress, and she has four children and four grandchildren and a husband to go with that. The way we'll proceed is that Jeff will give his paper, Nola will respond, and then we'll open it up for any questions that you may have of either of them.
Seems kind of strange with such a small group to be at a microphone, but go for it. Yeah. Okay. First of all, I'm happy to be here. I think the symposium is an exciting and a vibrant and important part of modern Mormonism, and I'm honored to be taking part in it. Before I begin my paper, I have two caveats that I want to first state. The first is my paper is quite narrow in focus, and although I am aware and sensitive to other household configurations and their unique problems in the church and in the job market, I'm focusing mainly on the forces impinging on women in more of a traditional family unit, which would be considered husband, wife, and possibly children going along with that. The second caveat is that I treat work, in this case a job, as an economic necessity rather than something that may be fulfilling in its own right. Although I'm aware that of course work can be kind of a quasi-consumption good that's fulfilling in its own right. With that then, I'll get right to my paper. According to Latter-day Saint doctrine and custom, the economic and family roles of men and women are well defined. President Benson, in an address in the October 1987 priesthood session, states that among the most important roles of men in the stereotypical LDS family are first, providing for its material needs, and second, providing spiritual leadership. Women in this family, on the other hand, are strongly encouraged to avoid working outside the home, so that they can fulfill their role of, quote, caring for and nourishing the children at home, unquote. Okay, so President Benson's speech is a response to an increasing number of LDS women leaving the home to engage in wage labor. This trend, he believes, is both destabilizing and destructive to the traditional family unit. There is no doubt that labor force participation rates of women have increased dramatically in the last 40 years. In 1950, 33.9% of American women were labor market participants. In 1985, this figure had increased to 54.1%. By far, this is a trend, this is the most important and revolutionary trend in the labor market in the past 30 or 40 years. Among women with preschool age children, approximately 44% are in the labor force. And incidentally, the labor force participation rate in Utah is higher than the national average. It's one of the highest in the states. The labor market participation rate of women. I'm not sure if I made that, but okay. The causes underlying increases in labor force participation of married women are many and complex and have been the subject of a large body of sociological and economic literature. This revolutionary shift has also been a concern of church leaders and members. In his 87 speech, President Benson warns that selfish desires for luxuries are no reason for women to enter into wage labor. Although this element of selfishness may, in some isolated cases, be behind increased labor force participation of women and mothers, there are also other strong economic forces at work over which we have little or no control. Okay, the purpose of this paper is to explore a number of these environmental economic forces affecting LDS families, and thus to place President Benson's advice in a particular historical and economic context. To do this, I explore changes in two categories in the economic environment that are behind increases in the proportion of mothers performing wage labor. The first category is the changing nature and economic significance of home production. And second is the stagnating living standards experienced since the early 1970s. This analysis, I hope, will offer some insight into the historical and economic context in which many LDS families make major decisions, such as whether or not to send a second member into the labor force. Okay, now I'm going to talk about the changing nature of home production. Okay, my argument draws on a distinction in women's traditional activities in the home as either production activities on the one hand or maintenance activities on the other. Production activities are those tasks which lead to the creation of consumer goods necessary for the family's subsistence. These activities may include the production of fruits, vegetables, care of livestock, preserving food for future use, making cloth, sewing clothing, food preparation, among other things. Okay, so those are the production activities. Okay, in addition to consuming these goods themselves, often the surplus production of these commodities was traded or sold to neighbors, which is yet an additional source of income to the family. Okay, production work done largely by women and children in the pre-industrial family was an indispensable source of income a woman could generate without leaving the home to engage in wage labor. And that's an important point. Okay, home production was not only performed by those in rural areas, although access to land is an important prerequisite to the performance of production work, but it was often the case that in newly industrialized areas, men would work in the newly forming factories for wages, while their wives would engage in productive effort at home. Okay, now it's important that you understand that both sources of income were important for the subsistence of the family at some culturally determined norm. The production work that women performed in the home tended to reduce the reliance of the family on the market and wage labor for its subsistence, and was a source of income independent of the labor market. The family's degree of reliance on the market for its subsistence is important, for the stronger is this reliance, the more will be the pressure for the woman of the family to engage in wage labor outside the home to help the family meet its subsistence needs. Okay, so we talked about production work, the traditional woman's production work. Now we're going to talk about the maintenance work. Maintenance work, as opposed to production work, on the other hand, refers to activities which maintain the family and its possession, such as caring for the sick or young, cleaning house, doing laundry, shopping, etc. Maintenance work has always been an important element of home production because it prolongs and maintains the life of family's possessions and provides important care for dependent family members. Maintenance work, however, unlike production work, does not necessarily provide materially for the household independently of the labor market. Often the performance of maintenance work itself requires the consumption of commodities that can only be bought in the marketplace. These things such as laundry detergent, washing machines, cleaning supplies, things like that. Okay. Because these consumption commodities can only be bought in the market, the family is tied more closely to income derived from wage labor for its subsistence. If the family is tied more closely to the labor market to obtain its subsistence, then there is a greater likelihood that additional family members, especially the woman, will feel compelled to enter wage labor to offer help with the material subsistence needs of the family. This may especially be the case for middle and working class families, where historically there has been less ability to survive at culturally defined subsistence levels on one family member's income. Okay, so both production and maintenance work in the home are important for the survival and the health of the family. Production work, however, is more important in terms of materially supplementing the family outside the system of wage labor. In pre and in early industrial periods, women could simultaneously stay in the home and provide care and nourishment for the family. Okay, this is important, so let me restate this. In the pre and early industrial periods, women could simultaneously stay in the home and provide and nourishment for the family and engage in production that directly generated income for the family. Okay. What happened to undermine the ability of women to perform these dual functions as we progressed from the 1800s into the early 1900s to the present? One answer is that the development of capitalist enterprise through the 19th and 20th centuries has gradually eroded the production component of home production, leaving more time to be spent on the maintenance component for women producing in the home. Increasing intrusion of capitalist enterprise producing in traditionally pre-market spheres, therefore, tends to tie the family closer to the wage labor market for its subsistence. Historically, capitalism has overtaken those pre-market activities, such as those performed by women in their home production. For example, in a small Midwestern town in 1890, only 25% of the bread was baked commercially. By 1929, this proportion had increased to 75%. The proportion of backyard gardens in 1890 was estimated to be 75 to 80%, but by 1929, this had decreased to 40 to 50%. Although women still could choose to make their own bread and grow their own vegetables, for capitalist enterprise, it was both cheaper and more efficient. As a survival strategy, therefore, producing items such as bread and vegetables at home becomes increasingly less important, as it is more efficient for capitalist enterprises to produce essentially the same commodities. Similar patterns of capitalist enterprise taking over production previously performed by women in the home developed in other production spheres as well. So, for example, clothing production. With these developments, among others, the economic function of women as managers of the vital household production process outside the system of wage labor continued to diminish. For married women, therefore, the performance of the type of production leading to production of goods originating outside the market is being replaced by their function of maintaining and preparing goods produced in the market. For married women to contribute to the material subsistence as she had in the past, increasingly she is forced to do this outside the home in the wage labor market. So that takes care of the first part of the change in the economic environment that has led to women increasing their labor force participation. Now the second part of this process that I'm going to look at is the stagnation of living standards. This is a little more contemporary. It's starts in 1970, in the 1960s and 70s. So, the changing mix between production and maintenance work in the traditional family would be of little significance for women who remained at home if the real wage levels of their husbands had risen to such a level so as to offset the value lost from the decrease in women's home production. And indeed, this is now the case for many middle and upper income households. It also appeared that many families could live on one income after the World War II period. Productivity and standards of living for many Americans rose quite steadily until the early 1970s. But a series of economic disasters struck about 1970. First, the financing of the Vietnam War effort, while simultaneously continuing spending on social programs, also along with oil supply shocks, all led to inflation. Okay, workers' wages often didn't keep pace with inflation, so living standards stagnated or fell. It is estimated by 1988, average real wages, and the real wages are wages adjusted for inflation, declined by 17.8% for the average male worker. At the same time, housing prices outpaced the general inflation rate by 7.5%. If there were if there ever was a family wage that was being obtained by a substantial proportion of working and middle-class household heads, then economic forces now are continuing to undermine it so that fewer and fewer men in a wide range of occupations will be able to continue to support their family at customary standards of living. There are also other factors in these stagnating living standards. The Depression of 1981-82 was the severest since the 1930s. The unemployment that accompanied this downturn was different than traditional cyclical unemployment. The job losses this time were often permanent. Industrial plants closed down or were moved overseas, leaving many long-time, well-paid workers with no job that could compare to the level of compensation to which his or her family was accustomed. A Bureau of Labor Statistics study of displaced workers shows this in 1979. This study is from 79 to 83. Notes that 5.1 million workers were displaced due to plant closings. Just under one-fifth of those were employed in the durable goods industries. Those workers who had been reemployed as of January 1984 were paid 35% less than at their previous jobs. That's quite a drop in standard of living for those 5 million workers. Also in the 1981-85 period, the unionized workforce, for the most part, either forewent wage increases or took pay cuts between 81 to 85. There's been no reports of this type of concession bargaining occurring in the unionized workforce prior to this time in the post-World War II era. Okay, another innovation in corporate strategy, undermining the ability of working and middle-class household heads to obtain a family wage, is the increase in the use of contingent or part-time workers. One of the arrangements that exists is the use of temporary or leased workers. Firms, in this case, simply hire workers for a specified period of time from an outside agency who takes care of all the administrative personnel tasks. While saving corporation money in terms of labor costs, this directly translates into a reduction in the standards of living for those who work under these arrangements. Part-time workers are often paid less than their full-time counterparts and receive less in the way of health and pension benefits. Another strategy that became popular was the use of outsourcing to avoid high-paid labor. For example, a large unionized manufacturing firm that outsources may discontinue a section of production of the production process by contracting to a smaller non-union firm. Employees who work in the unionized environment and lost their jobs for the larger firm may find themselves doing substantially the same work while getting paid far less. For example, Harrison and Bluestone cite an example of a man working as a pipe fitter for U.S. Steel who earned $13 an hour. After being laid off, he found himself working for a subcontractor making parts for his old employer at $5 an hour with no benefits. Okay, it is conceivable that a man earning $13 an hour and benefits can modestly support a family, a wife, and children. However, it would be virtually impossible at $5 an hour with no benefits. In summary, changing economic conditions over the past 20 years have made it increasingly difficult for the typical working or middle-class male to obtain a family wage. And I define a family wage as a wage that can support a family on one income. This, coupled with the decrease in ability of women to provide help with the subsistence needs of the family outside the sphere of wage labor, has put pressure on many women to supplement their husband's stagnating or declining income by entering the labor market. Although an increase in selfishness, laziness, and irresponsibility may be part of the problem underlying increases in labor force participation of married women, there are also very poignant economic pressures faced by many LDS families as they try to balance the need for subsistence and a modicum of decency with the desire to heed President Benson's advice. It is somewhat ironic that the very institution that receives substantial popular support among church members, that is, free market capitalism, appears to be a significant force in the breakdown of traditional gender roles in the family and the production process. Capitalist enterprise, while often efficient and progressive, has invaded the spheres of traditional home production activities and thus has deprived married women of their traditional source of material contribution to the household. In addition, competition in the marketplace and the concomitant needs to cut costs, including labor costs, has eroded the ability of many men to earn a family wage. The point is that for those women whose husbands do not make a sufficient income for subsistence at culturally acceptable levels, the contribution she can make to increase that standard of living is found increasingly by participation in wage labor outside the home. Okay, what are some of the implications then of these two forces impinging on people in the labor market? First of all, President Benson in his speech quotes the Doctrine and Covenants 83:2. Women, this is quoting now, women have claim on their husbands for their maintenance until their husbands are taken. He goes on to say, quote, this is the divine right of a wife and a mother. While she cares for and nourishes her children at home, her husband earns the living for the family, which makes this nourishing possible. While it may be true that pre- and early industrial women were caring and nourishing their children, it also appears to be true that they were producing a significant number of goods outside the system of wage labor, which were vital for the survival of the family. In this context, it made little economic sense for a woman to even think about entering the labor market because they were needed in the home to perform production tasks vital to the survival and reproduction of the household. Now that capitalist enterprise has taken over and is still in the process of taking over, many of the production tasks previously done by women and mothers in the home, it now makes much more economic sense for a woman to enter the wage labor force if she is to contribute materially to the survival of the household. This is especially the case in working or middle-class homes where the real wage of the male breadwinner has been substantially reduced in the past 20 years. The question is, what relevance does this have to us as Latter-day Saints who are strongly committed to the strength of traditional families? First, I believe the indictments of working mothers serve only to marginalize a significant portion of families who are suffering most under changing economic conditions, over which they have little control. As a working parent, I, too, have experienced the guilt and anguish of leaving my daughter at a daycare center before going to work. I've agonized over the quality of care that she may be receiving, over the developmental milestones that I may have missed. I also believe this feeling is quite universal among parents who feel it's a necessity to work outside the home. I'm sure that there are those who work outside for selfish reasons, but it must also be remembered that the line between luxury and necessity is often fuzzy. Is it a luxury to have a car or a television or a phone? Have these things become a necessity to be able to function in modern-day society? I know in Las Vegas, it's a necessity to have a car. If you don't have a car, you're completely isolated. Anyway, the point is that the ideal for many parents is to have sufficient resources to not have to leave the care of their children to someone else. I know it's the ideal for many parents is to have the choice whether or not to engage in the labor market, in wage labor. But often it is the case that the real and the ideal do not mix or do not coincide. For individual Latter-day Saints who feel the traditional family structure in which the father supports his wife and children is the ideal, one obvious solution is to invest in education. Educational attainment will often allow a worker to obtain the skills and hence a job which allow the traditional sorts of family division of labor as suggested by President Benson. Although this is good advice for the individual, there will always be those for whom this is not an option. Church leaders have to be careful not to marginalize members or potential church members simply based on their socioeconomic status. The church is not only for the rich or upper middle income groups, but it is for everyone regardless of their position on the socioeconomic ladder. In addition, the U.S. has one of the highest standards of living standards of living in the world. In many nations, it is absolutely necessary for there to be two or even more incomes in a household to make ends meet. Emphasizing traditional and rigid gender roles in the family and in the production process may turn out to be so culturally narrow that it also marginalizes members from other nations or cultures. Another possibility for church members to deal with current economic trends is to lobby business and government leaders to pursue reforms, making it easier for workers to obtain a family wage, or for the families to be able to subsist on one income. Among these reforms may be substantial increases in the minimum wage, also laws that increase the strength of the union movement to raise their bargaining power and workers' wages, and other pro-family reforms may be important. A lot of these liberal reforms aren't very popular with church members, I know, but that's kind of what my analysis leads to. Okay, I think President Benson's speech, above all, is a message that the care and nurturing of our children is one of our most important tasks. And generally, the best people to carry out this task are individuals that genuinely love and care for the children. In an ideal situation, the caregiver would be one of the parents. Selfish pursuits that take away from our parenting role, no matter what they are not good. Are not for the good of the parents nor the children. I am suggesting, however, that changes in the economic environment, not necessarily selfish pursuits, are behind the increasing numbers of families abandoning the traditional family division of labor as envisioned by President Benson. Economic trends, such as those discussed earlier, will continue to put pressure on traditional gender roles in the family into the foreseeable future. If these trends are recognized by both members and leaders for what they are, not solely as greed and selfishness, but as a response to a transformation in the economic environment, perhaps the social stigma can be erased, and creative solutions to problems facing an increasing number of LDS families may be found. The church, with its organizational powers and resources, has a large potential to serve its members in this area. Thank you.
I've approached my assignment to respond to this fine paper with some ambivalence. Although I feel that it is a well-reasoned and moderate exposition of the practical problems arising for those persons caught between their own economic necessities and the advice given by President Benson in his 1987 fireside address to mothers in Zion. The ambivalence is due to my own strong feelings in the area. I have a few statistics from the 110th edition of Statistical Abstracts based on the 1990 census to add. Dr. Waddups has given as his belief that economic necessity and not selfishness accounts for most of the influx of LDS mothers into the labor force. According to the abstracts mentioned, in 1988, the percentage of American women in the labor market had risen to 62.3 from the figure of 54.1 for 1985. Since the sources were different, I can't be certain that the figures are directly comparable. However, a breakdown on my 1988 figure, state by state, as compared with the national figure of 62.3, shows Nevada at 69.25, Colorado at 65.3, Utah at 65.8, Wyoming at 64.6, Montana at 62.9, and Idaho at 62.8. Of the region designated in the graphs as mountain, and where I would expect Mormons to be of some statistical significance, only Arizona at 60.5 is below the national average for female employment. Perhaps of more relevance is the report in the Deseret News of the 20th of July, 1990, by Max Knudsen, business editor. This was a new statistical report, the Consumer Credit Risk Quarterly, that compares the creditworthiness and bill-paying habits during 1989 of the people in the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, as well as in the 327 metropolitan statistical areas. Of the 51 states, Utah ranked 48th. with only Arizona in last place and Alaska and Louisiana ranking lower. The metropolitan area of the Ogden/Salt Lake City ranked 316th out of 327, 11th from the bottom, while Provo/Orem ranked 238th, slightly better, but still in the bottom quarter. Knutson placed a call to Mark Cam of the SMR Research and found that the factors considered in this were personal bankruptcy filings, measurement of bank savings and loan and credit union loans in such categories as delinquent, non-accrual residential mortgage loans. Utah scored well below the national average in all these categories. In 1989, Utahns had a rate of 4.28 bankruptcy filings per 1,000 compared to the national average of 2.5. Then he adds, Utahns should not take this as an indictment of their moral characteristics. There is a time in life when morals and the ability to do something conflict. They may have the best intentions to pay off loans, unquote. One would have to know a good deal more about this particular report before deciding its significance. But if it has any significance, it would seem to be that some Utahns, at least, do indeed find themselves in financial difficulty. This, of course, brings us back to Dr. Waddup's contention that much of the motivation for LDS mothers to enter or re-enter the labor force is genuine economic necessity rather than selfishness. But who is to decide what constitutes selfishness? Those who know their own circumstances uniquely and who must suffer the consequences of their decision, or church leaders of necessity kept remote by reason of physical frailty and advanced age? The danger is, and I do feel that this is a real danger, it seems to me to be twofold. First, to the most conscientious as well as to some of the most emotionally unstable and vulnerable among us. Advice from a church leader is often treated as if every word were a commandment from God to be followed to the death if necessary. I was present at a board meeting in Salt Lake City a week or two after President Benson had made the fireside address. Present also were two well-known LDS psychotherapists, both of whom expressed concern, even dismay, at the effect the address was having on some of their depressed and neurotic patients. The second danger I see is that feeling this particular address to have been ill-advised, there may be a loss of faith in the relevance of other counsel from this leadership. On the positive side, I was reassured by the response I received from one young woman. She and her husband are both extremely active in church, are parents of six children, three of whom have completed missions with a fourth to go in September. She and her husband had been caught in hard times and are both now full-time teachers. She said, "No, I didn't feel a bit guilty when I heard the speech. I knew what our circumstances were and I knew I had to work. I don't think he was talking to me." Here I thought, as a woman with enough ego strength to do what she knows to be necessary and who had enough self-confidence to know that guilt was inappropriate. I found myself hoping there were many like her, for I believe there will, of necessity, be many more women who enter the labor force and for valid reasons which include but are not limited to economic necessity. And yet, in a sense, President Benson was preaching to the converted. A recent August 12, 1990, telephone poll commissioned by the Los Angeles Times and surveying 1,000 households in Los Angeles and Orange counties revealed, according to Times staff writers Lynn Smith and Bob Sifkin, quote, "Haunted by anxiety about spending too little time with their children, nearly 40% of fathers and 80% of mothers in Los Angeles and Orange counties say they would quit their jobs if they could to rear their children at home. Most parents say they are often overwhelmed by the responsibilities of child rearing and worry about whether they are doing a good job of it." Psychologist and syndicated columnist Dr. Joyce Brothers attributed the closeness many men feel to their children to changes in domestic attitudes and behavior. In America today, only 10% of the homes fit the traditional breadwinner model, where the father goes off to work and the mother stays home to take care of the children, according to a study by the Ford Foundation. Fathers have, quote, "held more crying infants in the middle of the night. They've fed them, rocked them, changed their diapers, to say nothing of talking with school and camp counselors and attending PTA meetings," Brother said. That's the end of that quote. I find the information in this California survey sponsored by the Los Angeles Times to be encouraging and significant for us. Because the survey took place in a geographic area not predominantly LDS, I found it surprising that as many as 40% of fathers and 80% of mothers felt such need for personal involvement in child rearing that they would quit their jobs if it were economically feasible. Had the area surveyed been in the Utah and including the Salt Lake City, Ogden, and Provo, Orem areas, and had the sponsoring newspaper been the Deseret News, I wonder if the results would have been significantly different. To return to Dr. Waddup's paper, I found his analysis of factors contributing to the economic stresses which have led many middle and working class Mormon families to require the salaries of both parents to be particularly telling and not frequently given enough attention. I refer to the decline in real wages when adjusted for inflation, the depression of the 1981 and 82 period with closing of plants, etc., the use of part-time workers who are paid less per hour and receive fewer health benefits and pension coverage. I too find it ironic that, as he observes, quote, the very institution that receives substantial popular support among church members, free market capitalism, appears to be a significant force in the breakdown of traditional gender roles in the family and the production process, end of quote. Perhaps we need to more frequently remind ourselves that free market capitalism is, after all, an economic and not an ethical system. And while its strengths are many, at the same time that many of us reap its real benefits, others of us fall victim to the social Darwinism that is also inherent in it. Many church members are middle and working class. While we may applaud the good and intelligent business decision that cuts costs and may even save a small business, we should be cognizant of the fact that that same decision may also send another mother into the labor market because her husband's reduced wage can no longer support the family. There appear to be no easy answers to this problem. When these factors are combined with President Benson's advice, there are bound to be painful repercussions. As Dr. Waddup suggests, one obvious solution is to invest in education. Educational attainment will often allow a worker to obtain skills and hence a job which allows the traditional sort of family division of labor, as suggested by President Benson, to be viable. Janet Targen's Reflections on an Address to Mothers in Zion, printed in Sunstone in August of 1989, poses some penetrating questions on this subject. Quote, I was 18 when President Kimball gave the address referred to by President Benson in his remarks. I remember the message as being, live up to your potential. Bright, witty, capable Sister Kimball was certainly an example to us. I remember that we were told to plan for careers, to learn and to remain active. I remember the talk being inspiring and uplifting, not restrictive. Now I wonder about the 18-year-olds of today who hear the message that independence is the world's way for women and not the Lord's way. Why invest in an education? Why study? Why choose interests and pursue them when life is meant to be spent making beds and feeding others? Why plan for a meaningful career when in a few short years or months, motherhood will overtake all aspects of a young woman's life? I feel, and this is quoting from Targen, I feel that the messages do not postpone families and do not limit families are potentially dangerous. Why must a relationship be built on dependence and economic need rather than on independence and mutual respect? And I'm going to include a brief historical note here. Are we really certain that there is only one way for woman or for family? Historically, the Victorian-style family, father working, mother in the home with children, didn't exist before the late 18th century, flowered in the 19th century, but only in upper and middle classes, and mainly in urban areas. Working class women were largely servants in the home of their betters. One of the appeals of the working class, among whom the Mormon missionaries most generally labored, was that when they joined the church and came to America, they could remain in the home with their children. The Victorian angel in the home model of family appears to have been enshrined. Being prosperous enough to have the wife and mother in the home was a sign of status. That it was God's plan seems to have little scriptural backing either. We seem to have projected that concept into the scriptural past, as we have a good many things. The virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 does not fit this pattern, except to be good at handicrafts. One, she considereth a field and buyeth it. She planteth a vineyard. She bringeth her food from afar. She maketh fine linen and selleth it. She delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Her children rise up and call her blessed, but there's no evidence she cares for them personally. Her husband also, and he praiseth her, as well he might. He is known in the gates and sitteth among the elders. It's interesting to speculate what might happen if, and this is a very large if the church leaders were to decide that, yes, economic factors were the major reason that mothers were in the workforce, and that there were really other valid reasons why a woman might be a mother and still wish to work outside the home. If they were to decide this, and were to decide that since some mothers had to work, the central concern should be the welfare of the children and not the castigation of the mothers, what then might they concern themselves with? Hastening the relaxation and flexibility of rigid sex roles so that more men would feel comfortable and feel peer acceptance with sharing more household and parenting tasks so that fewer women need burnout or the double task of wage earner and traditional wife, or even economic role reversal if that should seem necessary or desirable within the family? Lessening efforts to keep women under male control by facilitating sharing of leadership tasks in a more meaningful way? Assigning some selected and well-qualified members to instructing both sexes in child development and child rearing as well as to name extraction that we might more positively affect the future of our children as well as perform our duties toward our dead? The possibilities are numerous and need not rule out church involvement in child care if we feel our values would not be adequately transmitted to our young in secular settings. We have the facilities. We now permit some of our facilities to be used for child care during aerobic classes. We, even in the Utah area at least, have the political clout and legal talent necessary to guide us through or even modify some of the bureaucratic restrictions and insurance concerns which at present make the providing of child care such a nightmare. Much has been left out. President Benson, while addressing mothers, seems to be speaking of the mothers in two-parent households. Dr. Waddup's remarks were purposely limited to the same context as mine have been. We should none of us forget that Christ's concern was not just with the 90 and 9, but with the one who did not fulfill a traditionally acceptable role. We have spoken at most to the 30 and 3 in traditional two-parent families. Surely we must also concern ourselves with the other 60 and 7. Thank you.
If there are any questions now, what I think we need to do is direct your questions to either of the speakers, and then they need to come here, restate the question because it's on tape and it won't pick up the question from the from out in the audience. Fred.
I don't have a question, but I'd like to make a comment.
Sure.
In our experience, my wife and I, we find as we look about ourselves that our experience was fairly typical of many, many LDS families. Due to World War II and a mission, I entered the workforce quite late. At 32, I finally got my degree in engineering. But by the time our first son was ready to go on a mission, my earning power had not risen to the point where we could really afford that and take care of the other children too. So my wife went back to her work as a legal secretary, working part-time. And she was made to feel guilty because she had to do that. Both her mother and her three sisters said, "Your place is in the home, not working." But in our economic situation, it was necessary. But my wife still felt this guilt of having to go to work and leave our children sometimes. But she found that if she worked part-time as a legal secretary, she could leave home, children went to school, and be home before they returned from school. And we did this for some time. Then as the other children came along for their missions, she continued to work, and the children became older, needed her less, but she was still there when they were home from school. I feel that we must take the teachings of the brethren and apply them to our situation only to the point where we realize that we are caring for our children properly and still giving them the opportunities that they need in the economic situations that exist. May I continue? I have another thought.
Wait, why don't we wait?
All right.
Why don't we see if there are other questions, and we'll give everybody a chance because we... back in the back. Go ahead.
Okay, the question is, it's only relevant, what President Benson said is only relevant if there's a significant number of people opting for a higher standard of living rather than having the wife in the home. I didn't really find any. The only evidence I have are my two arguments, or the two parts of my argument that's where decreased standards of living are accompanied by the decrease of the ability of the traditional wife to produce material subsistence. So I think that is evidence against families opting for a higher standard of living rather than having the woman stay home. But I also hear anecdotal evidence that would support President Benson's claim or what's implicit in President Benson's claim is that people are opting for this kind of luxuries. And, you know, you hear about the people who send their wife to work or maybe the families who have the wife working so they can support their boat and their camper and their summer home or whatever, but all it is anecdotal, and I don't know.
You have no.
But I don't have anything other than what I've said. So go ahead.
I concur in that. Mainly the horror stories that you hear about the extravagance and the necessity I haven't found any evidence for it, but then I haven't specifically looked for it. The people that I've personally discussed this with all have, it seems to me, sound economic reasons for requiring two salaries. Now, of course, if you don't consider a mission or further education a necessity, then if we're getting back to you really only need two shirts because you can wear one and wash one out. So here again, it seems to me that you have a question as to what is selfishness, and I don't know that there are any rigid guidelines that any person can make for any other person. It seems to me that's an individual matter which must be decided by the people involved.
I worked for the job service here in Salt Lake for 32 years before I retired. And then I worked for the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Kansas City and Washington, D.C. for 10 years because they kicked me out of Utah when I turned 65, and they let me work till I was 70 anyway with the federal government. But I would like to suggest that you look at another factor that has operated to make the decline, make the middle class not keep up, because the very top 5% are getting wealthier and the lower are getting more in the lower. By referring to the decline in the power of the labor unions, because when you the only thing you have to counteract the power of the special, the management on their power, is to have the labor unions. I think the worst thing that President Reagan did was break the air controller strike, because that has, it just seems like the labor unions have gone downhill since that happened about 10 years ago. The other thing is that you women have got, when you get in the secrecy of that booth, is look at what's going to happen here in Utah on removing the tax on food. I have spent, since retiring, a lot of time in California, and they do not tax your food. And this amounts to a real big item in the budget of the middle-class people, so think of that when you get there. That's all. I just want to suggest you look at that in your paper about the decline of the labor unions because of what Reagan did in the air controller strike.
Back here, over here.
Okay, so the first question is whether getting out of debt would have a significant impact on the economy. And the second one is what percent, whether or not women were getting paid the same for doing men's work during World War II, because first of all, let me answer your second question first. I don't know. I don't know those figures off the top of my head. The first one, first of all, I don't think that home production, I don't think that home production would have a real significant impact on the economy, because I don't think people generally have enough access to the resources they need to do enough home production to have any impact. That's just the way we live in our urbanized society. Now, about the debt thing, that's an interesting question. We are, of course, driven by debt. I mean, the debt is our national debt, personal debt has been increased substantially, and I think that may be what was driving our slow growth in the past 10 years. But whether or not, if everyone got out of debt, that would have a significant impact on the economy, I mean, I don't really know about that either. So,
go ahead.
Yeah, the comment was, is staying at home while it's involved in the Good Mother? Of course, no, but that's why I think it's important to when you hear advice from general authorities, to look at the general principles underlying what's being said. And in my paper, I said what I got out of that was the general principle is to not do things that... not engage in activities that are selfish and self-centered that will detract from parenting responsibilities. And so the real thing is the real message is take your parenting responsibilities seriously. That's what I got out of it. And anyway.
Janelle, I'm afraid we're out of time. I would encourage you, any of you who still have questions, come up and talk to the speakers. And I apologize that we are out of time. I'd like to thank both Jeff and Nola. They both did a wonderful job and raised some very thought-provoking ideas. Thank you for attending this session.